Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and the dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Today, I am proud to bring you Living Hermeticism, and my guest is Frater Serpentis Satori. Greetings and welcome, Satori. How are you?
All right. Other than the fact that we're supposed to get snow in Chicago this week.
Really? Wow. How bad?
Yeah, they're talking snow Tuesday night at the end of April.
Wow. Is it supposed to be
on top of everything else going on in Chicago right now? Yeah. A little bit of end of April snow.
and there is a lot going on in Chicago right now.
Yeah.
I finished with a book called Heal Your Ancestors to Heal Your Life. And I have a topic prepared. I wanted to go into ancestor work a little bit.
Oh, we were going to talk about mediumism and Mormonism and Thelema, because today's
okay.
418.
That sounds great. And it's a very timely and important topic at this particular point in time with all that's going on with the spiritual communities, with the rise of new prophets who are making all sorts of prophecies that do not reflect the reality we live in. But anyway,
there's a lot about that on YouTube after the election, about how all of those prophecies didn't come true, and all the craziness that ensued in the evangelical community because they thought they were going to pray Trump to a second term.
Yes. And the explanations they gave for why the prophecy did not come true were truly mind-bending and interesting.
Well, that's always the thing when prophecies don't come true or don't come true in the way you think the prophecy means.
Mm-hmm. And prophecies don't always...
But that's the problem with prophecy. That's the problem with prophecies.
Yeah, on a personal level, some things that were said that I didn't think would come true came true, but not in the way I expected them to come true. And they were true, although they didn't seem so at the time when I got the prophecy from spirits when I was a channeler these many years ago. I remember how I got into channeling. A friend of mine in high school who was also very sensitive and could see elementals and ghosts and, you know, all this type of stuff. There weren't that many people I encountered that could do that. So we became friends, and she started going to classes in New York City. So I wanted to check out the classes, part of it being protective because there was a lot of chicanery going on, always in the psychic community.
Right.
I went and met these people, and we were in a Greek diner, and we were talking, and then all of a sudden I started to feel very lightheaded, and I started to feel this energy traveling up from the base of my spine to my crown, and then when it got to my head felt kind of vague, and then a voice started talking to me and having a conversation with these people. And they seemed to recognize who the voice was and had a conversation, but I didn't. So that was very odd, and it required a lot of contemplation. But the result of that was they said that I was a medium, and they were waiting for a new medium. So I got into channeling. And for many years, I was a channel for a bunch of people with a theosophical background, and they were doing the blending between spiritualism and theosophy that Blavatsky warned against, But that's what was happening at the time with the IM movement and all of these type of movements that were springing up. And I did it for many years until I decided to stop. I didn't feel that was my true destiny. But I learned a lot by doing it. And I find that I have a better understanding of channel literature, both its strengths and its limitations and, you know, where you should question it. So it was all in all a very positive experience. And it strengthened my ties to theosophy, which I learned about in grammar school and in theurgy. So those became my main currents of spiritual inquiry. They became the common golden threads throughout my life.
I've worked with channelers since I was 13, because the Circe when I was in high school was a medium, and I'm the other extreme. I'm a summoner, so I'm always surrounded by weird spirits, but until you get a certain level, they're really only able to break through to you in like 5-minute intervals. So if they want to have like a 90-minute conversation with you, they have to talk through a medium.
Okay.
And then in college, I had a medium as part of my group too. So I've always been used to that. But I've been the other guy. I've been the guy who asks the questions. And I'm also the guy that tends to be like, we have a very unusual guest today. I'm like, yeah, I'm not, who is this? This isn't one of those normal, regular spirits. Who is this? This is Medimi. Oh, one of John Dee's spirits. How colorful. Well, I mean, the Crowley's wife channels what becomes the Book of the Law during Three Nights in the Pyramid.
Yes.
In April, which became the founding days of his religion. And the founding text of his religion, even though that is one of those books that you either think is complete Holy Scripture or is one of those badly channeled, mangled books, depending on your opinion of the Book of the Law.
Uh-huh.
Because it has a bit of everything in it.
Yeah, those books, they are communications from the beyond, but one has to be, again, very cautious because... They're coming through the consciousness of a human, and they're using the human brain and the human vehicle to communicate. And there's a lot of garbling and mistranslation going on.
No, that always happens. It always happens also with, like, the weirder stuff, even in a non-recorded channel session. You get all sorts of weird bits and pieces here and there that aren't necessarily prophecy, but are just weird bits that happen when you're doing medium work. That sometimes never really make any sense.
Right. Except for when they do.
Right. Except for occasionally you're like, oh, that's what that meant.
And some things.
And I thought that was leftovers.
Yeah, some things seem rather ominous when they're first uttered, but then they turn out to be something commonplace, but important.
I get that from Hecate all the time. Every once in a while, I'm like, oh, that didn't make any sense, but now that I'm in the present, I understand exactly what that was about.
Mm-hmm.
But that couldn't be stated explicitly. It had to be explained in a sideways, so by the time I understood what it was, I would be able to make use of it, even if it's sideways and a little odd. But spirits are that way, being multidimensional and having whatever relationship with time they actually have, however that really works.
And one of the things that is interesting about spirits too is and this I found to be very true, and other people found it to be true as well. Just because you're given a name doesn't mean that that's who you're communicating, if that. and you're communicating with, I hesitate to use the word underling, but somebody assigned to that staff is often who you're communicating with. So it might not be the same intelligence or entity that you're communicating with all the time. And certainly, if you compare what's said in other channeling sessions with other people, you could tell that it's different spirits communicating with a particular name.
Well, yeah, but that's also one of the dangers of Ouija boards and not having proper testing techniques, is you can be talking to anything claiming to be anything.
Right.
Unless you know how to properly test an entity and know for sure that's who you're talking to. That's one of the other dangers of just making it up as you go along.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there has always been an element within the spiritual community that back in New Orleans in the 90s, they were experts in absolutely everything.
Okay.
If you wanted to learn any kind of magic of any kind, you could get a referral because the five of us who were taking care of everything, between one of us, we would be able to point you in the direction if you wanted to learn Sufism or if you wanted to learn esoteric Hinduism. Those were all available. If you went to the top, you could get a referral for anything.
Okay.
But even still, you have there's a sort of thing in spirituality that at the time, the Queen of New Orleans used to call them the I know things people. That these are people who not only don't know very much, they utterly refuse to learn. And in addition to utterly refusing to learn, they brush up against the hierarchy because the hierarchy is based on status and levels and years-long training programs.
Mm-hmm.
But they know things, so they think they should be treated like the people who have been doing this for 15, 20 years who come from established systems. You don't have to belong to the same system of someone because you can tell whether it is all the chakra lights are lit up or however you understand that. People of the same level in the spiritual community can tell what level you are. You can't fake levels. You can't be a third-level magician and claim to be a 30th-level magician. That doesn't work. You get caught.
Well, people do. I've encountered many people in my travels who claim to be things that they can't be.
Well, right, but you're one of those people like I am because you're a demigod whose job is to call them out on being fakes. But it's in our current YouTube age, we have a greater rise of the I know things people, because if you can do it about politics, you can do it about anything, I guess.
Well, that is very true. We have an overabundance of information on everything and anything, but the information is not exactly good.
Information isn't education. Information isn't education. It never was in the world of spirituality, but we've had this conflict going on since the Victorian age, if not earlier. We have had the people who are the, like, drawing room mediums versus the more educated practitioners. This conflict has been going on at least for 200 years, if not all the way back to this being the conflict between the village witch and the established initiates, if that's even true.
That was part of the things we discussed in our theurgy forum this week.
Well, because it's the same underlying issue, but not necessarily because it's not the I know things people against the status-oriented crowd. The problem with the I know things people is people who know less than them follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're playing with things that even the leader doesn't understand because the leader doesn't understand anything.
That's why I've always been reluctant to identify myself as a spiritual leader. I more term myself a spiritual explorer or spiritual adventurer. I remember Socrates, his wisdom came from knowing that he didn't really know.
Yeah, but.
One of the things that's very interesting about channel literature that has always impressed me within a particular system of channel literature is its internal consistency. Like, for instance, I'll bring up the Unarius folks. You know, they have a wide library of hundreds of books of channeled literature. And I haven't read all hundreds of them, but I've read enough of them to be amazed by how, even though these were channeled by different individuals who were sub-channels at various times over decades, the information contained therein, although it's still channeled information and, you know, you need to keep that in mind when you're reading it, is very internally consistent with the details. And that's always meant a lot to me, this internal consistency.
Well, because it's probably coming from the same entities who have their fact checkers and stuff.
Yeah.
Angelic fact checkers or however that works over there. But that's also true if you deal with a lot of, if you're a magician who deals with a lot of channeling and you work with a lot of channelers through your career, all of the five channelers I worked with for more than 9 months, if I did have that whole body of material, it's internally consistent as long as I'm asking the questions, which
okay.
I guess was Crowley's issue too, because Crowley went through a dozen or so mediums after his divorce. Someone correct me on that. I think it's a dozen.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think that may have been Riccardi who said that. So I'm not sure about that number, and I'm not sure about all their names. But Crowley says something similar about, like, he can always tell when it's Awash because Awash always, you would say verbal tics if it was like a musician like Taylor Swift, but there are certain ways reality comes through if you're dealing with the same entity.
And you find that information that you, again, you couldn't have known, like through the Unarius entities, I met Herodotus. Or Herodotus, as it's called in Greek. And the Herodotus that I spoke to, who, you know, had a sense of humor, explained to me things in the history that I've always, been unclear about. So he just sat down and explained everything. And with the theosophical literature, Olcott is said to have held a lecture that grated on people's nerves for some reason. And I wanted to know why he had that. And at the time, during my young channeling days, Olcott came and explained it. It made perfect sense, not only why he did what he did, but why it would grate on people's nerves that he did it. So you're able to get a lot of useful information through channeling, if the channeling is, again, not the imagination of the channeler.
Right, if it is a legitimate entity, and people like us tend to have regular characters who pop into the medium.
Correct. And they have different roles.
Right. They're guiding us in different ways, but very few, only people like you and I have more than two or three, because I guess three is the norm, even in, like, when you're taught mediumship. But people as unusual as you and I have a much larger set of characters, which is why mediums like working with us, because they don't get stuck in having to only play three roles. They're like, oh, Medimi's here. Oh, it's Medimi. It must be. She has a long commute. We have to talk to her. That's a long commute from the Enochian universe. Hopefully she didn't park the starship somewhere she can't find it. But no, I remember having that happen at one point, because one of the other people in my group didn't know who that was. And he's like, that was an interesting look on your face. I'm like, she doesn't want to talk very much. Must be urgent or something. like, who's that? She's sort of John Dee's main spirit guide, but Dee's true relation is Dee goes through a bunch of different weird entities narrating to him at different points in True and Spatial Relation, and we're missing probably 200 pages that were used to line Pythons. So, yeah, the infamous Pythons issue. But even though we have what we think is the complete works of Dr. Dee, we're missing between 50 and 500 pages, depending on which estimate you want to use.
They were used to line Pythons, really?
Yes, they were. Yep. The original transcripts. When Dee was out of favor after Dee had problems with King James and was considered a sorcerer and a witch and lost all his status and had all the problems that happened after Elizabeth died.
That's a shame.
One of his main entities was Medimi, but if you're more familiar with Seth and Aranius and all of the New Age stuff, you have no idea who that is.
Right.
And you realize she has a weird, funky alien vibe. And I'm like, oh, no, she actually has a speech where she says, we are goodly spirits true unto God. That's one of her most important speeches in Dee's book. Yeah, and then my medium, as soon as she left, is like, no, she definitely was not an angel. Like, I've always understood the Enochians to be the Vorlons in Babylon 5. I always understood them to be some sort of, like, weird super entities that are treating us as the ant farm. Sort of like, oh, look how cute. Now they're dealing with COVID. Look how cute.
I actually
look, they think they can deny COVID.
I actually have a Vorlon on one of my altars to remind me of the fact that the entities, the gods, you know, whatever you want to call them in your explorations, are enigmatic, and they're actually beyond our understanding in very many ways. So the Vorlon reminds me of that because of Babylon 5.
That's one of the major issues that always annoys me about Christians is they're still trapped in Jesus and well, my Irish witch friend from New Orleans, one of her main issues is if the three monotheistic religions all come from one God, why are you all killing each other all the time? Does your God just have bad mismanagement skills?
Well, when I was...
Can you not hold together a unit of government? Is it inability to hold together a unit of government? What is it?
When I was a kid, the Greeks explained it that when Paul went to the Rock of Ares was slighted. So when Jesus came to Greece, Ares killed him and assumed his guise and made the religion of peace into a religion of war. So that's how the modern-day Greeks explained that. And aside from hearing that tale on Lemnos by Lemnians, I've heard it by other Greeks over the years in this country as well. So there is that belief, and that might explain things.
Yeah, but one of the issues I've always handled that issue as being with the masks of God answer, because that's the most legitimately Greek answer, the most Egyptian answer, because the Egyptians have the Neter Neter,
mm-hmm.
which is the God beyond gods, which again is if God is infinite and all powerful. We can't really imagine infinite and all-powerful. Infinite and all-powerful is a little bit beyond what we can understand. So we make God like us, and we create this cast of superheroes and call them our gods. And then we create family relationships and politics and romances and intrigue. And then you just jive with the pantheon you jive with. But one of Christianity's problems has always been that they think all other gods are false, although they don't realize they're a religion of love that has the highest body count. Even if we just keep track of Christian on Christian violence. Their religion's been destroying itself for 300 years.
Well, that is because of the insistence on the one. It's one of the ill effects of believing that there's only one way or one God, that your interpretation happens to be the one way to that one God. And then people who have a different interpretation are trying to mislead everybody, so they're enemies, and they must be dealt with. One of the things I like about the older ways of spirituality is that people have different opinions, and that was it. Basically, this is my belief based on who I am and what I know, and the ancients ranged very widely in their beliefs, and eventually the point was to hook up with the gods yourself and know in your own way, but then you learn that the gods don't communicate with everybody in the same particular way anyway, so your way is not necessarily superior to anybody else's way.
But that's the problem with this, the one-ism, the one true way trip.
So you have like Zeus, and Zeus came close to becoming a monotheistic god, although it didn't go all the way in that direction, fortunately. But there's so many different understandings about Zeus, and so many different aspects of Zeus, and so many different epithets of Zeus that you ask yourself, which Zeus are they talking about when they're saying a particular thing about Zeus? And all of these things were legitimately believed by the ancients. They left voluminous writings. So, again, you see that as in Gnosticism, you have to find your own answers.
Yeah. That's always the advantage of being pagan and polytheistic is you have a – you don't need – we don't need clergy. One of the advantages of being pagan and polytheistic is we have our own patron. And as I have to remind my Christian housemate every once in a while, I note more when I don't realize Hecate doesn't have my cam on. When I'm like, oh, she's doing something else right now. I'm not live. Usually I'm live. Normally she's like, what's he doing? It's Sunday. Is he watching the Talking Head shows?
Yeah, I basically the way I see it, Jesus has been a Greek god now for over two millennia. So he's there with the whole Greek spiritual experience. And again, Greeks vary widely. I grew up in a household where it was okay if I was slated to Olympus after I died because I could visit, because God could not be good if he didn't let family visit each other in different heavens or hells or, you know, wherever they happen.
Well, that's what I tried to explain. Because the short answer to the heaven-hell question is, I don't remember if it was Ginsberg who said it, that Buddhists have on Christianity that they have 10,000 hells.
Uh-huh.
So if it's all about going to hell when you die, Buddhism has a much wider range of hells, so it would probably better to be a Buddhist because there are more hells.
And I'm sure some of them are more pleasant than others.
Well, when you have 10,000 hells. But my Irish witch friend at one point got asked the inverted version of that question about paradise. And I've always understood that to be just like a Masks of God issue too, that we're all hanging out in the same paradise. We just don't see it the same because we weren't told to think it's the same.
Right. And that's proven here in this reality, whatever we happen to believe this reality is all about. And this is where a lot of people get the whole secret law of attraction thing, a little bit off, is that how you experience things is less impactful. How things are is less impactful than how you interpret things to be. because what your reality becomes is what your interpretation is of what happens to you. So even though in an absolute sense you may not be able to control reality, you can certainly control your reaction to reality in a variety of different ways. So what could be catastrophic to one soul might not be such a big deal, you know, to another. So where we have that control is where you do all your positive thinking and all the other type of a law of attraction type of work. And you find when you do that, that it's a remarkable amount that you have control over.
Yeah.
So then, of course, whereas many people could be living in a hell, you could be living in a heaven undergoing the same circumstances, or at least in a neutral place where it's neither hell nor heaven. It's like an in-between limbo type of place, or
right,
a purgatory type of place where you're paying past karma and avoiding making new karma.
Yeah, that's also the thing about how much of reality is really interpretation.
Right.
And that's one of the more difficult things to learn on the path. Because I was trying to explain, you know, in the world of magic, we have to be very careful with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Because when I wander into places where I'm not sure what's going on and how cause and effect would change it, people of my power level with my understanding tend to just watch for a little while.
Wise.
I don't want to walk in throwing fireballs if I don't know who the bad guys are. That could be problematic.
I've learned to look at reality in part. It's a metaphor. It's not an actual thing, but to look at it as a mirror. And to see what my reactions are to what I see in the mirror, and to realize that those are my reactions. What I see reflected might not actually be what's happening. And an example of what can happen is, did you see the Veritas Project tape on CNN recently on YouTube? Well, basically, like, we know that the things on Fox are propagandized. You know, they're storytelling,
right,
to build a particular type of audience. Well, somebody from CNN, pretty much in a recorded conversation that they didn't know was being recorded, admitted the same of CNN, that they had an agenda and they were telling stories and they don't know what the real reality is, but they were, you know, basically selling a particular, you know, narrative. Now, I tended to trust what I was getting from CNN, but all of a sudden it was revealed that perhaps I can't and, you know, I shouldn't. I should deal that with the same amount of skepticism as I do with information that I get from Fox. Because some of the information on Fox is accurate. You know, they're not only telling lies, but their truth is slanted. So I saw through this clip that I can assume the same about CNN. So it's no longer as trustworthy a source of information as I thought. And there, too, we get attracted to the interpretations of reality that fit most closely with what we like to tell ourselves. So that's important to know when you're looking into the mirror of the world, you know, the funhouse hall of mirrors of the world. Again, we're attracted to a particular way of seeing things, and we tend to go to places for information that will reinforce what we believe already. And that's scary.
Yeah, beginning originally with church and country.
Right. And
beginning with what we want to believe about the divine.
Right.
That's something I also realize monotheists don't understand as well as polytheists, is the mask of God you prefer is a preference.
Right.
If you want the bipolar evangelical God, you've chosen that.
Right.
You want that on an unconscious level, because Jung calls that the imago Dei, the image of God we have inside ourselves.
Right.
Part of why I've never been interested in Christianity, because I'm a dark goddess worshiper. And Lilith is not at all what I'm into.
But if you grow up believing that there is only one, and the one that you're being presented is the only one. Like, for instance, I went to Greek parochial school for 8 years, and we were told that all other Christians, except maybe the Catholics, because they've been around for thousands of years too, are wrong about their interpretations of Christianity. They were made up, and only the Greek Orthodox Church, and to some degree the Catholic Church, because they were there from the beginning. They've actually, you know, were there at the inception of Christianity, are the correct Christian ways. And everybody else, they might as well believe in, you know, pagan idols, you know. So I know a lot of people who never questioned that and remained faithful Greek Orthodox, you know, for their entire lives, and are still faithful Greek Orthodox. And I still have many Greek Orthodox people in my family, some of them very near and dear to me. So we just chalk it up with, hey, we'll visit each other. You know, we're all together here. We'll visit each other in the afterworld, you know, and that's okay. But that's not true in every family. Some families are very against the pagan gods. And I remember speaking to monks and other people from Athos, which is the holy mountain of Orthodoxy, and some of them are engaged in active warfare with the Catheon, and you know, they're very dismayed at the rise of neo-paganism in Greece again.
Yeah, but that was the inevitable problem of them burning all our priestesses and destroying everything and trying to impose monopoly rather than trying to survive in a free market economy.
And that happened over time, and it was inexorable, and in some ways it was inevitable. But Greeks are perverse like everybody else in some way. And with the Greeks was their unwillingness to let go of their past heritage, even if they were no longer spiritually aligned with it. So that helped preserve a lot of this old information and to revere it. And it became part of the educational system in the West, where educated people were familiar with stories. So these stories were able to survive, and we still have them. The Hellenic spirituality of antiquity is very well represented in actual literature, rather than relying solely on channeled or scholarly interpretations. But I know that the gods we resonate with are preferred, and I've also learned, because I had resonances with different things when I decided to leave my native beliefs and explore the beliefs of other people, that for a while it was like playing hide-and-seek with God, and then eventually discovering that it's the same God behind all these different masks, then discovering...
That's a certain state of the past. That's a certain state you go through on the path where you have to learn about my God in every country.
Right.
Because my witch friend in New Orleans was going through that, and she was in a situation where she worked at a voodoo shop, was an Irish witch, but was hanging out with Shivites. And I'm like, no, you're a level behind me. You're dealing with Isis under all of her names. Because ISIS has a name in every religion, even Christianity. Christianity largely stole everything from ISIS. All the stuff in Christianity that isn't Jesus is ISIS. Sorry, kids, that's all ISIS shit.
And some of them have several names in a particular system, like Hercules. There are several Indian versions, meaning Hindu Indian versions of Hercules. And
right.
In Christianity, he's Luke, the glorious physician. He's also Michael, the archangel. So they appear under different guises. And even in Greece, there were over 44 Herculeses. I forget which Roman author chronicle that, and we know of at least two through the stories, the Idaean dactyl Hercules and then the Hercules of Thebes. But there was one Hercules who was short. There was another one who was an engineer who dealt with like waterways and draining swamps, you know. So there are all these Belus, the god Belus was considered Hercules. Balarama, the twin of Krishna, was considered Hercules. Krishna was considered Hercules. So you have all of these different cultural iterations, and life is not long enough this life for me to explore all of them. So after exploring like half a dozen of them, I got the point, and I learned to recognize them through various ways, through their symbols usually, and through certain key stories. It's like looking at the different facet of a much larger jewel. But yes, the Olympian pantheon is mine because of preference, and that's an optimal way to communicate, because I'm so imbued with it and permeated with it.
Yeah, and then like you like what you have in Olympus, so you have no reason to change to Hinduism or Santeria or whatever else.
Right, and that's very freeing. And as you said, you choose your God. It's Imago Dei, so it becomes your issue. Why would you choose this aspect of the divine and claim it as not only yours, but claim it as you on some level? So that's
right.
Sort of a quest as well. There was
that's the hardest. That's what always strikes me as odd about people who are neo-pagan, who are at that crystal worship pre-patron level and are afraid to get involved with deities because they think deities are whatever that is, but they refuse patronage, and then they wonder why they don't have any good stuff. Like, no, that all flows from pantheon and patron. As long as you want to be independent, that's the trade.
Right.
You don't have to do what anybody tells you, but you don't have credit cards.
That's a very creative and unique way of communicating patronage. And
well,
yeah,
as a child of Hecate, everybody's always trying to be like, can you put the Death Star on your credit card? Like, I have to call in first. I have to see if I can do that on installments or something. Didn't it take them like 30 years to build that thing? How much was that per month? Well, 1 second, I need to make a couple phone calls.
Well, talking about the Death Star, too, we've had numerous conversations, a couple of them here on the show, about how our popular culture's stories are part of our modern mythology, and the avatars of the gods appear in these stories as well, and they're there if you know how to look for them. Sometimes they don't even change them. You have different versions of the same god appearing in the same mythology, like with Marvel. You know, you have Hercules, and then
Loki's TV show is finally coming out soon.
Yes. And Loki,
speaking of gods on television, Loki's coming soon.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. Not going to get to see it till when it comes out on DVD, but I'll watch the videos explaining all the Easter eggs and what really happened. So by the time I see it, I'll know pretty much what to expect.
Right. But I mean, it's because our gods really are superheroes. And we understand that in the way we understand that. And it is underpins our popular culture, because at the archetypal level, we still project ourselves upward into Superman and Wonder Woman and whatever. We still see those as ideals and idealized versions of ourselves, even if we're wobbly about calling Superman a god.
Right. And DC,
even if we're not sure that's okay.
Well, DC and Marvel have been pretty straight about it. DC especially has been publishing kids' books showing how the Flash is actually Hermes, you know, that Wonder Woman is actually, like the Amazons in antiquity with Athena and Artemis and several others pitched in. That I don't think DC said this, but enough other people have said it, that Batman is like Hades. I think you even made that
Batman is Osiris. It's in that book about Rick Riordan, there was a series of books that were put out for like high schools and prep schools that were using different series of young adult books as like English classes for an entire semester. And
okay.
There's one called like Harry Potter and Philosophy. The Rick Riordan and Philosophy book actually talks about how Batman is Osiris. This is crystal clear because if you're one of the five people that saw the Halle Berry Catwoman movie, in the middle of the Halle Berry Catwoman movie, she's told Catwoman has always been Isis.
Right, I remember that. I'm one of the
right.
People,
so Catwoman is Isis and Batman's Osiris. All of that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, I like the movie. A lot of people, it gets a bad rap when people talk about it, but I enjoyed that movie, and I still have it. I still have the PS2 game, too, although I don't have a PS2 anymore.
I know enough people who worship ISIS that at a certain point they see that movie, even if it's like at a bar or something, where they buy it for a dollar at Salvation Army.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, how come no one talks about this movie? I'm like, it's one of those movies like those last two Batman movies that DC tries to pretend didn't really happen. They're in great denial about that, even though it's not really a bad movie. It's just not really a good one.
Well, now with the multiverse, and the multiverse is... been popping up all over the place in our television shows, in our movies, in our books, in our speculative science. I think that's going to catapult us forward into a new level of understanding, because you have like infinite possibilities, infinite variations, and a whole different way of looking at the reality we're living in.
Yeah. And that also expands our... then more people begin to understand alternate timelines and alternate versions of themselves.
Right. And we talked about that. That's something that now, especially with the internet, you're becoming aware of how many people experience that. Before, when you relied on word of mouth or things that people shared through books or articles, it seemed like a very rare thing. But now that people are sharing on the internet, it seems that a lot of people have had that experience.
Now that our major comic universes are, well, they've been discussing it since Doctor Strange, since
mm-hmm.
the weird tripped out thing a half hour into Doctor Strange's movie.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Multiverse of Madness, the second Doctor Strange movie.
When they get done writing it. They keep changing it. They keep not being sure what it's about. So we'll see how that turns out. Because the last time Marvel did that with a movie was Civil War. So we'll see what the final product looks like.
Well, it should be interesting at any rate. Even the ones that weren't as stellar as the other ones, still they're part of the tapestry, and they contribute toward the unfolding of a greater tale, and that I think is wonderful.
Well, it's also interesting because they are I'm interested to see how they're going to pull in Moon Knight and Blade, because it does sound like the plot of Moon Knight and Blade is going to be Dracula.
Yes. That's what
it looks like we're going through the Dracula arc in both those stories to set up whatever Dracula and Doctor Doom are doing in whatever version of Secret War we're heading toward.
It will definitely be interesting. So far, what they've come up with on television has been interesting. Again, I didn't see the whole things, but I've been watching clips from other people, both WandaVision and Falcon and the Winter Soldier seem awesome. And Loki is, of course,
yeah.
What I've seen of that blows everything else out of the water. Now, one of the things that I've been working on for quite a while now, and it's finally, now with the podcast, it's coming together, are the cosmic channelings. And I have several groups on the channel that, are channeling entities from other planets or belong to systems of belief that are based on the channelings of entities from other planets. And although there are dissimilarities, there are also many similarities. So I've started conversations between people in these various groups to just kind of explore the similarities a little bit more. And before the pandemic, I was helping distribute some of their literature when I was giving talks about these things throughout New Jersey. And when the pandemic's over, I'm going to continue. But there too, even though, again, the story is different, the mythology is a little different, there are still, in many ways, these great consistencies that I've been able to find. So that's what my...
Those non-local entities, once you get away from the Greek gods and the angels, when you start talking to spirits with long commutes, they all tend to say the same thing because they wouldn't be that interested in what was going on in our world right now if they weren't nudging us in certain directions.
And that's been consistent, the directions that we're being nudged in. And a lot of it has to do with our experimentation with forces of nature that can destroy us and our planet. So that's been consistent in all of them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that some of the environmental crises that we're facing now were predicted in panel literature back in the 50s.
Yeah. That's when we began to realize it because we covered it all up in the 80s. That's called the climate denial dossier. We all know that we knew all about this in the mid-70s and chose to do nothing.
Well, now it's coming more in the open. More and more politicians are acknowledging that we're having a global climate crisis. And also that our upcoming wars will be around water rather than oil.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find that very much worthy of contemplation because, we're entering a dystopian vision of the future, and our science fiction, which is very visionary literature, has been showing us that for quite a while. And we've had story after story after story after story. And we've made movies of these tales and made fandoms that glorify these tales, had toys and games based on these tales. But again, we've done very little to not have this type of future.
We have to totally rethink that 50s lifestyle. The whole world we created after World War II isn't sustainable.
And now there are political movements trying to bring this vision of the future that led to so many problems back. And that's something that we're seeing, that the Elysium that they're trying to create is actually what's generated our problems that we can see very clearly in the world today.
Yeah.
So what do we as magical folks, how can we address this most effectively?
Well, it is get in touch with your spirit guide and learn to communicate with them at least once a week.
Mm-hmm. And how can people learn?
Then they'll be able to nudge you into doing what's most important for you.
And how can people learn to discern what is a actual communication, where the communication is coming from, or whether it's their imagination?
Start with automatic writing. Eventually it becomes much clearer where those two or three voices are, and then eventually you need to have enough focus to only be listening to one of them at a time. But most people can't really do that.
Meditation helps.
Meditation helps, but it's very difficult for most people to undo the three-part harmony.
One of the other techniques...
You're used to hearing all three of those voices talking over each other all the time.
Right.
And most people can't zero in on one of the three voices.
You can learn
to do it, but that takes a long time. It takes a long time. It takes understanding what you're listening to and why.
Right.
So just being able to do automatic writing and get what you can get out of automatic writing, at least, is listening. It's a while before you figure out who you're listening to and what they're trying to tell you, but at least listening is a useful step. And you can learn something even from the most basic automatic writing exercises.
So that would be somebody's first step, just basically grab a pen, a pad, and just write. And
yeah.
Then go back and see what it is that you've written.
That takes a while. It takes a while to just get through neurosis and all the daily neurotic stuff that this world fills us with. But once you get through the neurosis, you start to realize the voices. Whatever school of psychology or magic you want to use, it's usually agreed that there are usually three main voices.
Now
We've
reached the end of today's conversation. We only have a couple of minutes left to go. People can still contact you through me. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. We have like a minute to continue what you were saying, and I'm sorry, I lost track of time.
It's that the once you start listening to your patron, they'll make themselves more clear about who they are, and then you don't get trapped in the traffic circle of not having a patron to guide you, so you're wandering around the spirit world without any good maps or without any good help. But lots of people choose that, I guess, because they don't want to be involved with spirits. And that was my... I'll stop there.
So it goes to the old occult dictum, when the student is ready, the master will appear.
Always. But the problem is the people that don't want to be taught. There's the whole thing about people who think they know too much, so can't learn. And we even had that problem in New Orleans in the 90s. We had that small subsection of people that thought they knew everything, not realizing who was sitting at the table in front of them.
Yeah, I stick with Socrates. The extent of my ignorance is awesome. And I've lived through enough paradigm shifts in my life to know that just because I see things in a particular way at this particular point in time and it makes sense, doesn't mean it'll make sense if I step down someplace else.
Right.
Thank you very much. To be continued. And thanks to everybody for tuning in, whether you tuned in live or later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures.